judge. She had doubts about its veracity, but was curious enough to take the next step. What if it were true? What if Lacey Stoltz topped off her stellar career with another pinnacle? Another glorious moment that solved half a dozen cold cases and captured headlines. She told herself to stop dreaming and get on with the day. She took a quick shower, spent a few minutes with her hair and makeup, threw on some jeans and sneakers, put down food and water for Frankie, and left her apartment. At the first intersection, she eased through a yield sign, one that always reminded her of her car crash. It was odd how certain landmarks triggered certain memories, and each morning she looked at the sign and flashed back. The memory was gone in an instant, until the next day. 3 years after the nightmare, she was still cautious behind the wheel, always yielding, never exceeding the limit. At the western edge of town, away from the Capitol and the campus, she pulled into an old shopping center, parked, and at 8:05 entered Bonnie's Big Breakfast, a local hangout with no students, no lobbyists. As always, it was crowded with salesmen and cops. She picked up a newspaper and found a seat at the counter, not far from the kitchen window where the waitresses chirped at the cooks who snapped back their own colorful comments. The menu offered a poached egg on avocado toast that was legendary, and Lacey treated herself to it at least once a month. As she waited, she checked her email and text and was pleased that all the important messages could be put off for 24 hours. She sent a note to Darren with the news that she would not be in. He replied quickly and asked if she was quitting. Such was the mood around BJC these days. Those still hanging around were suspected of planning their escapes. At 9:30, Lacey was on Interstate 10 going west. It was March 4th, a Tuesday, and each week on that day at about that hour, she expected a call from her older brother and only sibling, Gunther. He lived in Atlanta, where he was a player in the real estate development business. Regardless of the market, he was always upbeat and on the verge of another major deal, conversations that Lacey had grown weary of but had no choice but to endure. He worried about her and usually hinted that she should shuck her job and come make some big bucks with him. She always politely declined. Gunther lived on a tightrope and seemed to relish borrowing from one bank to pay another, always one step ahead of the bankruptcy lawyers. The last career she could imagine was building more strip malls in the Atlanta suburbs. Another recurring nightmare was having Gunther for a boss. They had always been close, but 7 months earlier their mother had died suddenly, and the loss made them even closer. And, Lacey suspected, so had her pending lawsuit. Gunther believed she was due millions and had developed the irritating habit of tossing around investment advice for his kid sister. She was not looking forward to the day when he needed a loan. Gunther lived in a world of debt and would promise the moon to secure more of it. "Hey, sis," he said cheerfully. "How's it going down there?" "I'm fine, Gunther. And you?" "Got the tiger by the tail." "How's Allie? How's your love life?" "Pretty dull. He's out of town a lot these days. And yours?" "Not much to report." Recently divorced, he chased women with the same enthusiasm as he did banks, and she really didn't want to hear about it. After two failed marriages, she had encouraged him to be more selective, advice he routinely ignored. "You sound like you're in the car," he said. "I'm driving to Pensacola to chase down a witness. Nothing exciting." "You always say that. Are you still looking for another job?" "I never said I was looking for another job. I said that I'm getting a bit bored with the one I have." "There's more action up here, kid." "So you've said. I don't suppose you've talked to Aunt Trudy lately." "Not if I can help it, you know." Trudy was their mother's sister, a real busybody who was working too hard to keep the family together. She was grieving over her sister's sudden death and wanted to share her misery with her niece and nephew. "She called 2 days ago. Sounded awful," Lacey said. "She always sounds awful. That's why I can't talk to her." Strange, isn't it? We barely spoke to the woman until Mom died, and now she really wants to be pals. She's struggling, Gunther. Give her a break. Who's not struggling these days? Oops. Look, got another call. It's a banker who wants to throw some money at me. Gotta go. We'll call later. Love you, sis. You too. Most of their Tuesday chats ended abruptly when he was besieged with other, more important calls. Lacey was relieved because he usually asked about her lawsuit. She called Darren at the office just to say hello and reassure him that she would indeed be back tomorrow. She called Allie and left a voicemail. She turned off her phone and turned on the stereo. Adele, live in London. 5. Thanks to GPS, she found the Brookleaf Cemetery in an old section of Pensacola and parked in the empty lot. Just ahead was a square, bunker-like building that could only be a mausoleum, and beyond it were acres and acres of tombstones and monuments. It was a slow day for burials, and there was only one other car. She was 10 minutes early and punched in Jerry's number. She answered with, "Are you in the copper-colored Subaru?" "I am. Where are you?" "I'm in the cemetery. Go through the main gate and past the old graves." Lacey walked along a paved trail lined with weathered monuments and family tombs, the last stops for the prominent from other centuries. With time, the tombs lost their significance and yielded to elaborate headstones. Quick looks to both sides dated burials to mere decades ago. The trail turned to the left, and Jerry Crosby appeared from behind one of the few trees left standing.
"Hello, Lacey," she said with a smile.
"Hello, Jerry. Why are we meeting in a cemetery?"
"Thought you might ask."
"I could say it's privacy, a change of scenery, other reasons."
"Let's pursue the other reasons."
"Sure." She nodded and said, "This way." They walked past hundreds of headstones and could see thousands in the distance. On a slight incline far away, a crew of gravediggers labored under a purple canopy. Another casket was on the way.
"Here,"
Jerry said as she stepped off the trail and wound her way around a row of graves. She stopped and nodded silently at the final resting place of the Leawood family. Father, infant daughter, and son Thad, who was born in 1950 and died in 1991. After staring at the single headstone for a moment or so, Lacey was about to start asking questions when Jerry said, "Thad was a local boy, grew up around here, went off to college, came back, got a job as a social worker, never married. He was an Eagle Scout and loved scouting, loved working with kids. Coached youth baseball, taught kids in church, that sort of stuff. Lived alone in a small apartment not far from here. In his mid-20s, he became scoutmaster of Troop 722, one of the oldest troops in the area. He treated it like a full-time job and seemed to love every minute of it. Many of his former scouts still remember him fondly. Others, not so much. Around 1990, he abruptly quit and left the area amid allegations of abuse and molestation. It became a scandal, and the police opened an investigation, but nothing came of it because the victims backed away. Can't really blame them. Who would want the attention? After he left town, things settled down, and the alleged victims went silent. The police lost interest. After he died, the case was closed. He died young, Lacey observed, and waited for more.
He did.
He lived in Birmingham for a while and drifted here and there. They found him in Signal Mountain, a small town outside of Chattanooga. He was living in a cheap apartment and driving a forklift in a warehouse. Went out for a jog one evening and never came back. Some kids found his body in the woods. The same rope around his neck. A nasty blow to the head, then asphyxiation. As far as I can tell, he was the first, but who knows? I'm sure you have a file. Oh, yes. There were stories in the Chattanooga paper, and the Ledger covered it down here. Short obit. The family brought him back for a simple ceremony, and here he is. Seen enough? I guess. Let's walk. They followed the trail back to their cars. Jerry said, get in and I'll drive. It's a brief tour. If you had lunch? No, I'm not hungry. They got in Jerry's white Toyota Camry and drove away. She was extremely cautious and nervously checked her rearview mirror. Lacey finally said, you act as though someone is following you. That's the way I live, Lacey. We're on his turf now. You can't be serious. Dead serious. For 20 years, I've stalked the killer, and at times I think he's stalking me. He's back there somewhere, and he's smarter than I am. But he's not following you. I can't be certain. You don't know for sure? I don't think so. Lacey bit her tongue and let it go. A few blocks away, Jerry turned onto a wider street and nodded at a church. That's the Westburg Methodist Church, one of the largest in town. In the basement, there is a large fellowship room, and that's where Troop 722 has met forever. Can I assume that Ross Bannock was a member of the troop? Yes. They drove past the church and weaved through several streets. Lacey bit her tongue to suppress a flood of questions. It was apparent that Jerry was telling the story at her own pace. She turned onto Hemlock, a lovely shaded street with pre-war homes, all well-preserved with narrow drives and flower beds around the porches. Jerry pointed and said, that blue one up there on the left. That's where the Bannock family lived. Ross grew up there, and as you can tell, he could walk to school and church and Boy Scouts. His parents are dead, and his sister got the house. She's a good bit older. He inherited some land next door in Chavez County, and that's where he lives, alone. Never married. They drove past the house. Lacey finally asked, was his family prominent? His father was a beloved pediatrician who died at the age of 61. His mother was an eccentric artist who went nuts and died in an institution. The family was fairly well known back then. They were members of the Episcopal Church just around the corner. Evidently, it was a nice, cozy little neighborhood. Any allegations that he was molested by Thad Leawood? None. And no evidence of it. As I said yesterday, Lacey, I have no evidence. Only assumptions based on unfounded theories. Lacey almost said something sarcastic, but let it go. They turned onto a wider street and drove for a few minutes with no conversation. Jerry turned and the streets were narrower, the houses smaller, the lawns not as well manicured. She pointed to her right and said, up there. That white frame house with the brown pickup, that's where the Leawoods lived. Thad grew up there. He was 15 years older than Ross. They drove past the house. Lacey asked, who lives there now? Don't know. It's not important. All the Leawoods are gone. Jerry turned at an intersection, then zigzagged away from the residential areas. They were on a busy highway headed north. Finally, Lacey asked, so how much longer is the tour? We're getting there. Okay. As we drive around, mind if I ask some questions? Sure. Anything. The crime scene up in Signal Mountain and the investigation. What do you know? Almost nothing. The killing was in an area that was popular with joggers and walkers, but there were no witnesses. According to the autopsy, the time of death was between 7 and 8 p.m. on a warm day in October. Leawood punched the clock at the warehouse at 5:05, the usual time, and left. He lived alone and kept to himself, Very few friends. A neighbor saw him jog away from his apartment around 6:30, and as far as the police know, that was the last he was seen. He lived at the edge of town, not far from where the walking trail begins. The traffic thinned as they left the sprawl of Pensacola. A sign read, "Cullman, 8 miles." Lacey said, "I take it we're going to Cullman." "Yes. We'll cross into Chavez County in about 2 miles. Can't wait." "Be patient, Lacey. This is not easy for me. You're the only person I've confided in, and you have to trust me." Back to the crime scene. Yes. Back to the crime scene. The police found nothing. No hairs or fabrics. No blunt instrument. Nothing but the nylon rope around his neck. Tied off with the same knot, a double clove hitch. And it was the same type of nylon rope. Yes, identical to the others. A sign informed them that they were now in Chavez County. Lacey asked, "We're dropping in on Judge Bannock?" "No, we are not." They turned onto a 4-lane highway and began passing the sprawl of Cullman. Fast food restaurants, travel motels, shopping centers. Lacey asked, "So what did the police do?" "The usual. They dug around, went door to door, talked to other joggers and walkers and co-workers, found a friend or two. Searched his apartment, nothing was missing, so they ruled out robbery as a motive. They did their best but got nowhere." "And this was 1991? "Yes. A very cold case with no clues." Lacey was learning patience and took deep breaths between questions. "I'm sure you have all of this in a file." "I do." "How do you gather this information from the police? They are notoriously protective of their files." "Freedom of information requests. They'll comply to some degree, but you're right, they'll never give you everything. All they have to do is claim it's an ongoing investigation and slam the door. However, with the old cases, they sometimes relax a little. That, plus I go talk to them." "Doesn't that leave a trail?" "It could." They turned off the highway onto an exit ramp and followed a sign pointing toward the historic downtown. "Ever been to Cullman?" Jerry asked. "I don't think so. I checked last night, and BJC has not had a case here in the past 20 years. Several in Pensacola, but things have been quiet in Chavez County." "How many counties do you cover?"
"Too many.
We have 4 investigators in the Tallahassee office and 3 in Fort Lauderdale. That's 7 for 67 counties, 1,000 judges, 600 courtrooms."
"Is that enough?"
"For the most part. Thankfully, the vast majority of our judges behave, with only a few bad apples."
"Well, you've got one here."
Lacey did not respond. They were on an extended section of Main Street. Jerry turned off of it, turned again, and paused at an intersection. Across the road was an entrance to a gated community. Behind the gate were modern homes and condos with small, neat lawns. Jerry said, "Dr. Bannock bought this land raw 40 years ago, and it was a good investment. Ross lives in there, and this is as close as we'll get. There are a lot of surveillance cameras."
"I'm close enough," Lacey said, and wanted to ask about the benefits of knowing where he lived, but she held her tongue. As they drove away, she said, "Let's get back to the local police up there. How do you talk to them without worrying about leaving a trail?"
Jerry chuckled and offered a smile, a rare one. "I've created a fictional world, Lacey, and in it, I am many characters. A freelance journalist, a crime reporter, a private investigator, even a novelist, all with different names and addresses. In this case, I posed as a crime reporter from Memphis, working on a long story about cold cases in Tennessee. Gave the chief my business card, even a phone number and email."
Short skirts and a lot of charm can work wonders. They're all men, you know, the weaker sex. After a few friendly chats, they open up, somewhat.
How many phones do you have?
Oh, I don't know. At least half a dozen. Lacey shook her head in disbelief. Plus, you have to remember that this case is all but forgotten. It's considered cold for a reason. Once the police realized they had nothing to work with, they lost interest in a hurry. The victim was not from their town and had no family to poke around and pressure them. The crime seemed thoroughly random and impossible to solve. In some of these cold cases, the cops even welcome a fresh set of eyes digging through the file. They were back on Main Street in the historic section. A stately Grecian courthouse came into view in the very center of the town. The square around it was busy with shops and offices.
That's where he works, Jerry said, looking at the courthouse. We won't go in.
I've seen enough. There are cameras everywhere.
Do you really think Bannock would recognize you? I mean, come on, you've never met the man, and he has no idea who you are or what you're after, right?
Right. But why take the chance? Actually, I walked in one time, years ago. It was the first day of a term, and the courthouse was crawling with people, over 100 prospective jurors summoned for duty. I stayed in the crowd and had a look around. His courtroom was on the second floor, his office just down the hall. It was really weird, almost overwhelming, just being in the same place as the man who killed my father.
Lacey was struck by the certainty of her words. With no proof, no evidence, she was convinced Bannock was a murderer. And she, Lacey, was expected to get involved and somehow find truth and justice.
They circled the square and left downtown. Jerry said, I need some coffee. You?
Sure. Is the tour over?
Yes, but we have much more to talk about.
6. At the edge of town, they stopped at a chain restaurant and went inside. At 2:30, the place was empty, and they chose a booth in a corner, far away from the deserted bar. Jerry carried a large bag, too big for a purse. Lacey assumed it contained files. They ordered coffee and sipped ice water while they waited. Lacey said, On more than one occasion, you've described Thad Lee Wood as the first. Who was the second?
Well, I don't know how many victims there are, so I can't be certain Thad was the first. My project has uncovered 6 so far.
Thad was 1991, and I think my father was number 2 the following year.
Okay, and you don't want me to take notes?
Not yet.
Danny Cleveland, the reporter, was 2009. So was he the third?
I don't think so.
Lacey exhaled in exasperation. Forgive me, Jerry, but I'm pulling teeth here. I'm getting frustrated again.
Be patient. Number 3, on my list, anyway, was a girl he knew in law school.
A girl?
Yes.
And why did he kill her?
The coffee arrived, and they went silent.
Jerry mixed in cream and took her time. She glanced around casually and said,
Let's deal with that one later. We've talked about 3. That's enough for now.
Sure, but just curious, do you have more proof in the other 3 than you have for the first ones?
Not really. I have motive and I have method, that's all. But I'm convinced they're all linked to Bannock.
Got that. He's been on the bench for 10 years. Do you suspect him in any case after he became a judge? In other words, is he still at it?
Oh, yes. His last one was 2 years ago, a retired lawyer living in the Keys. A former big firm guy they found strangled on his fishing boat.
I remember that, Cronkite or something like that.
Cronky. Perry Kroenke, 81 years old when he caught his last fish. It was a sensational case. Well, at least for Miami. Down there, they have more murdered lawyers per capita than any other place. Quite a distinction, huh? Drug trafficking. Of course. And the connection to Bannock? He was an intern in Kroenke's firm in the summer of 1989. Then he got stiffed when there was no job offer. Evidently, it really pissed him off because he waited 2 decades to get revenge. He has remarkable patience, Lacey. It took Lacey a moment to absorb this. She sipped her coffee and looked out the window. Jerry leaned in and said, "In my opinion, as a pseudo-expert in serial killers now, it was his biggest mistake so far. He murdered an old lawyer with many friends and who once had a fine reputation. 2 of his victims were men of stature, my father and Kroenke. And their murders were 20 years apart. Yes, that's his MO, Lacey. It's unusual but not unheard of for sociopaths. I'm sorry, but I'm not up on the lingo here. I deal with judges who are mentally sound for the most part and screw up when they ignore cases or mix personal business with their judicial duties." Jerry smiled knowingly and sipped her coffee. Another glance around, then. "A psychopath has a severe mental disorder and antisocial behavior. A sociopath is a psychopath on steroids. Not exactly medical definitions, but close enough. I'll just listen and you keep talking. My theory is that Bannock keeps a list of people who have harmed or slighted him. It could be something as trivial as a law professor who embarrassed him, and it could be something as devastating as a scoutmaster who sexually abused him. He was probably okay until he was raped as a child. It's hard to imagine what that would do to a kid. That's why he has always struggled with women." Again, her certainty was disarming, yet astonishing. She had been chasing Bannock for so long, his guilt had become a hard fact. She continued, "I've read 100 books about serial killers, from the gossipy tabloids to the academic treatises. Virtually none of them want to get caught, but yet they want someone out there, the police, the victims' families, the press, to know they are at work. Many are brilliant, some are incredibly stupid. They run the gamut. Some kill for decades and are never caught. Others go crazy and do their work in a hurry. These usually make mistakes. Some have a clear motive, others kill at random. But they're usually caught, right? Hard to say. This country averages 15,000 murders a year. 1/3 are never solved. That's 5,000 this year, last year, the year before. Since 1960, over 200,000. There are so many unsolved murders that it's impossible to say this victim or that victim died at the hands of a serial killer. Most experts believe that's one of the reasons they leave behind clues. They want someone to know they're out there. They thrive on the fear and terror. As I said, they don't want to get caught, but they want someone to know. So no one, not even the FBI, knows how many serial killers are loose. No one. And some of the more famous were never identified. They never caught Jack the Ripper." Lacey couldn't suppress a laugh. "Forgive me, but I find it hard to believe that I'm sitting here in Podunk, Florida, having a pleasant cup of coffee and talking about Jack the Ripper." "Please don't laugh, Lacey. I know it's bizarre, but it's all true." "What do you expect me to do?" "Just believe me, Lacey. You have to believe me." Lacey stopped smiling and drank some more coffee. After a long pause, in which neither made eye contact, she said, "Okay, I'm still listening. Using your theory, are you saying that Bannock wants to get caught?" "Oh, no. He's too careful, too smart, too patient. Plus, he has too much to lose. Most serial killers, same as other killers, are misfits from the fringes of society. Bannock has status, a rewarding career, probably some old family money. He's a sick man, but he puts up a good front. Church, country club, stuff like that. He's active in the local bar, president of a historical society, even fancies himself as an actor, the county thespian group. I've seen two of his performances. Just dreadful. You watched him on stage? Yes. The crowds were small, for good reason. But the theaters were dark. It wasn't risky. He doesn't sound antisocial. As I said, he puts up a good front. No one would ever suspect him. He's even seen around the Pensacola area with a blonde on his arm. He uses several, probably pays them, but I don't know that. How do you know about the blondes? Social media. For example, the local chapter of the American Cancer Society holds an annual gala, black tie and all. His father, the pediatrician, died of cancer, so Bannock is involved. It's a big gala, and they raise a lot of money. Everything gets posted online. Not much is private anymore, Lacey. But he doesn't post anything. Nothing. No social media presence at all. But you'd be surprised what you can dig up when you live online like I do. But you said everything leaves a trail. Yes, but casual browsing is hard to track, and I take precautions. Another long pause as Lacey struggled for the next question. Jerry waited nervously, as if the next revelation might frighten away her new confidant. The waitress breezed by with a pot of coffee and refilled their cups. Lacey ignored hers and said,
"A question. You said that most serial killers want someone to know that they're out there, or whatever.
Same for Bannock? Oh, yes. There's an old saying among FBI investigators that sooner or later, a man will sign his name. I got that from a book, maybe even a novel. I can't remember. I've read so much. The rope? The rope. He always uses a 3/8-inch nylon cord, marine grade, double twin braided, light duty. A length about 30 inches long, wrapped twice around the neck so hard that the skin is always cut, and secured with a double clove hitch knot probably learned in the Boy Scouts. I have crime scene photos from every murder but Cronky's. Isn't that careless?
It could be.
But then who's really investigating? There are 6 murders in 6 different jurisdictions, 6 different states over a 20-year period. None of the 6 police departments have compared notes with the others. They just don't work that way, and he knows it. And only one in Florida. Yes, Mr. Cronky, 2 years ago. And where was that? The town of Marathon in the Keys? So why can't you go to the police down there and show them your files, give them your theory? That's a good question. It may happen, Lacey. I might be forced to do so, but I have my doubts. What do you think the police will do? Chase down 5 cold cases from 5 other states? I doubt it. You can't forget that I have no proof yet. Nothing concrete to give the police. And for the most part, they've stopped digging. Lacey sipped her coffee and nodded along, unconvinced. Jerry said, "And there is a much more important reason I can't go barging in with scant evidence. It's terrifying, actually." "You're afraid of him?" "Damned right I am. He's too smart to commit a murder and leave it alone. For 20 years, I've operated under the assumption that he's back there watching, still covering his tracks. And you want me to get involved?"
"You have to, Lacey. There's no one else."
"I don't believe that."
"Do you believe me?"
"I don't know, Jerry. I really don't know. I'm sorry, but this is not sinking in yet."
"If we don't stop him, he'll kill again."
Lacey absorbed this and was rattled by the casual use of the pronoun We.
She pushed her coffee cup away and said, Jerry, I've had enough for one day. I need to digest this, sleep on it, try to get my bearings.
I get it, Lacey. And you have to understand that it's lonely out here. For many years now, I've lived with this. It has consumed my life and at times pushed me to the edge. I've spent hours in therapy and still have a long way to go. It caused my divorce and almost ruined my career, but I can't quit. My father won't allow it. I can't believe I'm here now, finally at the point of telling someone, a person I trust.
I haven't earned your trust.
But you have it anyway. There's no one else. I need a friend, Lacey. Please don't abandon me.
It's not a question of abandoning you. The biggest issue is, what am I supposed to do? We don't investigate murders, Jerry. That's for the state boys or maybe even the FBI. We're just not equipped for work like this.
But you can help me, Lacey. You can listen to me, hold my hand. You can investigate on some level. The BJC has subpoena powers. In the casino case, you took down a crooked judge and an entire criminal gang. With a lot of help from others, primarily the FBI. I'm not sure you understand how we work, Jerry. We don't get involved in allegations of wrongdoing until someone files a complaint. Nothing happens until then.
Is the complaint anonymous?
Initially, yes. Later, no. After the complaint is filed, we have 45 days to investigate the allegations.
Does the judge know about your investigation?
That depends. Most of the time, the judge knows he or she has a problem. The complaining party has made it known they're unhappy and have issues. Some of these disputes have dragged on for months, even years. But it's not uncommon for the judge to get blindsided. If we decide the allegations have merit, which is rare, we file a formal notice with the judge.
And at that point, he'll know my name?
That's usually how it works. I can't remember a case where the complaining party remained completely anonymous.
But it could be done, right?
I'll have to talk to the director, my boss.
That scares me, Lacey. My dream is to nail the man who killed my father. My other dream is to keep my name off his list. It's too dangerous.
Lacey glanced at her watch and shoved her cup away another inch or two. She exhaled and said, Look, I've had a lot for one day and I have a long drive. Let's take a break.
Sure, but you have to promise me complete confidentiality, Lacey. Understood?
Okay, but I have to discuss this with my boss.
Can he be trusted?
It's a she, and the answer is yes. This is delicate work, as you might guess. We're dealing with the reputations of elected judges, and we understand discretion. No one will know anything until they have to know. Fair enough?
I guess. But you have to keep me in the loop.
The 20-minute drive back to the cemetery was subdued. To keep things light, Lacey asked about Jerry's daughter, Denise, a graduate student at the University of Michigan. No, she did not remember her grandfather and knew little about his murder. Jerry was intrigued by Lacey's life as an attractive single woman who had never married, but that conversation fizzled. Lacey was accustomed to such curiosity and had no patience with it. Her dear late mother had hounded her for years about growing old alone and childless, and Lacey was adept in deflecting the nosiness. At the cemetery, Jerry handed her a cloth shopping bag and said, Here are some files, just some preliminary stuff. There's a lot more.
For the first three, I presume.
Yes, my father, Dad Lee Wood, and Danny Cleveland. We can discuss the others later. The bag was heavy enough already, and Lacey wasn't sure she wanted to take possession. She couldn't wait to get in her car, lock the door, and drive away. They said their goodbyes, promised to talk soon, and so on, and left the cemetery. Halfway to Tallahassee, Lacey's phone buzzed with a call from Allie. He would be in late,
and wanted a pizza and wine by the fire. She had not seen him in 4 days and suddenly missed him. She smiled at the idea of cuddling up with a seasoned FBI agent and talking about something other than their work. 7. Darren Trope bounced into her office bright and early Wednesday morning and began with, "Well, well, how was the PD? Do something exciting?" "Not really." "Did you miss us?" "No, sorry," Lacey replied with a smile. She was about to reach for a file, one of about a dozen stacked neatly in a rack at the corner of her desk. A judge down in Gilchrist County was irritating both lawyers and litigants alike with his inability to set cases for trials. Alcohol was rumored to be involved. Lacey had reluctantly decided the allegations had merit and was preparing to notify his honor that he was under investigation. "Sleep late? Long fancy lunch somewhere with our FBI boy?" "They're called personal days for a reason." "Well, you didn't miss anything around here."
"I'm sure of that."
"I'm going out for some decent coffee. Want anything?"
"Sure, the usual."
Darren's coffee runs were taking longer and longer. He had been at BJC for 2 years and showing all the usual signs of being bored with a stalled career. He left, she closed the door behind him and tried to concentrate on another drunk judge. An hour passed with little progress, and she finally shoved the file aside. Maddie Reese was her most trusted colleague around the office. She had been there for 4 years, and among the four lawyers, was now second in seniority, far behind Lacey. She tapped on the door as she walked through it and said, "Got a minute?" The last director had imposed an open-door policy that had led to a freewheeling culture in which privacy was almost impossible and work was routinely interrupted. But he was gone now. And though most office doors were closed, old habits were hard to break. "Sure," Lacey said. "What's up?" "Cleo wants you to review the handy matter, thinks we should get involved." Cleo was Cleopatra, the secret nickname of the current director, an ambitious woman who had managed to alienate the entire office in a matter of weeks. "Not handy again," Lacey said in frustration. "Oh, yes. Seems he keeps overturning zoning ordinances in favor of a certain developer who just happens to be a friend of his nephew." "This is Florida. That's not uncommon." "Well, the adjoining landowners are upset, and they've hired lawyers. Another complaint was filed against him last week, and things do look rather suspicious. I know how much you love zoning cases."
"I live for them. Bring me the file and I'll take a look."
"Thanks." And Cleo is calling a staff meeting for 2 this afternoon.
"I thought we suffered through those on Monday mornings."
"We do, but Cleo is making her own rules." Maddie left without closing the door, and Lacey looked at the screen on her desktop.
She scrolled through the usual lineup of emails she could either ignore or postpone and stopped at one from Jerry Crosby.
"Can we talk? I'll call you. Number is 776-145-0088. Your phone won't recognize it." Lacey stared at the email for a long time as she tried to think of ways to avoid a response. She wondered which of the half dozen cell phones Jerry was using. Hers buzzed and the number appeared. "Hello, Jerry," she said as she walked to the door to close it. "Thanks for yesterday, Lacey. You have no idea what that meant to me. I slept last night for the first time in forever."
"Well, I'm glad you did." Even with Allie's warm body next to her, she'd had trouble shutting out the events of the day.
"That's nice, Jerry. Yesterday was quite interesting, to say the least. So, what's up?"
The question threw her. She suddenly realized that her new friend might feel the need to call every day for updates.
"What do you mean?"
"Well, what do you think? What's next?" I haven't thought about it, she lied. A day out of the office and I'm still trying to catch up.
Sure, and I don't mean to bother. Forgive me, but I'm so relieved that you're on the case now. You have no idea how lonely this has been.
I'm not sure there is a case, Jerry.
Of course there is. Did you look through the files?
No, I haven't gotten there yet, Jerry. I'm busy with other stuff right now.
I see. Look, we need to meet again and cover the other victims. I know it's a lot for you to digest so soon, but I dare say nothing on your desk could possibly be as important as panic.
True. Everything in the office paled in comparison to allegations of murder against a judge.
Jerry, I can't just drop everything else and open a new case. Any involvement on my part must be approved by the director. Didn't I explain this?
I guess. Brushing it aside, she continued. I'm in class today and tomorrow, but what about Saturday? I'll make the drive over and we can meet somewhere private.
I thought about this driving home yesterday for 3 hours, and I still don't see how we have any jurisdiction. We're just not equipped to investigate a murder, singular or plural.
Your friend Hugo Hatch was murdered in a staged car wreck, and I believe there was another murder in the casino case. Right, Lacey? You were involved in that one up to your ears. Her tone was becoming aggressive, but there was still a fragility in her voice.
Calmly, Lacey replied, we talked about that, and I explained that there were real detectives in that case, even the FBI.
But you made it happen, Lacey. Without you, the crimes would not have been solved.
Jerry, what am I supposed to do? Go to Signal Mountain, Tennessee, and Little Rock, Arkansas, and Marathon, Florida, and dig through old police files and somehow find evidence that isn't there? The police, the pros couldn't find it. You've been trying for 20 years. There is simply not enough proof.
6 dead people. All killed the same identical way, and all 6 had a connection to Bannock.
And you think that's not enough? Come on, Lacey. You can't let me down here. I'm at my wit's end. If you turn your back on me, then where am I supposed to go?
Anywhere. Just please go away. Lacey exhaled and told herself to be patient.
I understand, Jerry. Look, I'm busy right now. Let's talk later.
If she heard this, she didn't acknowledge it.
I've checked around, Lacey. Every state has a different way to deal with judicial complaints, but almost every state allows an aggrieved party to initiate an investigation in some anonymous way. I'm sure it can be done in Florida.
Are you willing to sign a complaint?
Maybe, but we need to talk some more. It seems possible to do it with an alias or something, don't you think?
I'm not sure right now, Jerry. Please, let's talk tomorrow.
As soon as she managed to end the call, Darren finally arrived with her almond latte almost an hour after he had left to fetch it. She thanked him. And when it appeared as though he wanted to loiter and share the break, she said she needed to make a call.
At noon, she eased from her office, left the building, walked 5 blocks to meet Allie for lunch. BJC's secret weapon was a badly aging woman named Sadell, a career paralegal who decades earlier had given up on the bar exam. She had once smoked 3 packs a day, many of them around the office, and had been unable to quit until she was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. Suddenly motivated, she'd laid down her smokes and made preparations for the end. 7 years later, she was still on the job and working more hours than anyone else. BJC was her life, and she not only knew everything, but remembered most of it as well. She was the archive, the search engine, the expert on the many ways judges could screw up their careers. After the staff meeting, Lacey sent her an email with some questions.
15 minutes later, Sadell rolled into her office in her motorized chair, an oxygen tube attached to her nose. Though her voice was strained, scratchy, at times almost desperate, she nonetheless enjoyed talking, often far too much. She said, "We've done this before. I can think of three cases in the past 40 years in which the aggrieved party was too spooked to sign on. Perhaps the biggest one involved a judge down around Tampa who discovered cocaine. He was thoroughly seduced by the drug, and it became a real problem. Because of his position, he found it difficult to buy the stuff." She paused for a second to take on oxygen. "Anyway, his problems were solved when a drug dealer appeared in his court on charges. He got friendly with the guy, gave him a light sentence, and eventually got in bed with his pusher, who was in with a major trafficker. With a steady supply guarantee, the judge really went off the deep end, and things deteriorated. He couldn't do his job, couldn't sit on the bench for more than 15 minutes without calling a recess for a quick snort. The lawyers were whispering, but as usual, didn't want to squeal. A court reporter was watching closely and knew the dirt. She contacted us, terrified, of course, because the gang had some nasty boys. She eventually filed a Jane Doe complaint, and we went in with subpoenas, the works. She even funneled documents. And we had plenty of proof. We were preparing to bring in the feds when the judge agreed to step down so he was never indicted." Her face contorted as she sucked in more oxygen. "What happened to him?" "Killed himself. They called it an accidental overdose, but it looked suspicious. Saturated with coke. I guess he went out the way he wanted."
"When was this?"
"Not sure of the exact date, but it was before your time."
"What happened to the court reporter?"
"Nothing. We protected her identity and no one ever knew. So yes, it can be done."
"What about the other two cases?"
"Either Jane or John, not sure, but I can find them. As I recall, both were dismissed after the initial assessment, so there wasn't much to the allegations."
Another pause to reload, then she asked, "What kind of case you got?"
"Murder." "Wow, that could be fun. I can't remember one of those other than the casino case. Does it have merit?"
"I don't know. That's the challenge right now, trying to determine what might be the truth."
"An allegation of murder against the sitting judge."
"Yes, maybe."
"I like it. Don't hesitate to keep me in the loop."
"Thanks, Sadell."
"Don't mention it."
Sadell filled her scarred lungs, put the chair in reverse, and scooted away. 8. The painter's name was Lanny Verno. Late on a Friday afternoon the previous October, he was on a ladder in the den of an unfinished home, one of several dozen packed together on an unpaved street in a sprawling new subdivision just outside the city limits of Biloxi. He was touching up the trim at the edge of a 12-foot ceiling, a gallon bucket of white paint in one hand, a 2-inch brush in the other. He was alone. His co-worker had already left for the day, the week, and the bar. Lanny glanced at his watch and shook his head. Still working past 5 on a Friday. A radio in the kitchen played the latest country hits. He was eager to get to the bar, too, for a rowdy night of beer drinking, and he would have already been there but for the promise of a check. His contractor was to deliver one by quitting time, and Lanny was growing irritated as the minutes passed. The front door was open, but the music drowned out the sound of a truck door closing in the driveway. A man appeared in the den and greeted him with a friendly hello. "Name's Butler, county inspector." "Come on in," Verno said with hardly a look. The home was a construction site with steady foot traffic. "Working mighty late," Butler drawled.
"Yeah, ready for a beer."
"Anybody else here?"
"Nope, just me, and I'm on the way out."
Bruno glanced down again and noticed that the inspector had on disposable shoe covers, a soft blue in color. Odd, he thought for a second. Both hands were covered with matching disposable gloves. The guy must be some kind of germ nut. The right hand held a clipboard. Butler said, "Remind me where the fuse box is." Bruno nodded, said, "The end of the hall."
He dipped his brush into the bucket and kept painting.
Butler left the den, walked down the hall, checked all three bedrooms and the two baths, and hurried to the kitchen. He glanced out the dining room window and saw no one. His pickup was parked in the drive behind what could only be a painter's truck. He returned to the den and, without a word, shoved over the ladder. Bruno yelled as he tumbled and crashed against the fireplace hearth, his head landing hard on the brick. Stunned, he tried to scramble and get his feet under him, but it was too late. From his right pants pocket, Butler pulled out an 8-inch steel rod with a 12-ounce lead ball on the tip. He affectionately called it Letty. He flicked it like an expert, and the telescopic rod doubled, then tripled in length. He karate kicked Furno in the ribs and heard them crunch. Furno shrieked in pain, and before he could make another sound, the lead ball landed squarely at the back of his cranium, shattering it like a raw eggshell. For practical purposes, he was all but dead. If left alone, his body would rapidly shut down, and his heart would beat slower and slower until the 10-minute mark when he stopped breathing. But Butler couldn't wait that long. From his left pants pocket, he pulled out a short length of rope, 3/8-inch nylon, double twin braided, marine grade, bright blue and white in color. Quickly, he wrapped it twice around Verno's neck, then rammed his knee into the spinal cord between his shoulder blades and yanked both ends of the rope savagely, snapping back his neck until the top vertebrae began popping. In his final seconds, Verno grunted one last time and tried to move, as if his body instinctively fought to save itself. He was not a small man, and in his younger days had been known to brawl. But with a rope cutting into his throat and his skull fractured, his body had lost all strength. The knee in his back kept him pinned while the monster tried to decapitate him.
His last thought may have been one of amazement at the power and strength of the guy with the goofy shoe covers.
Butler learned years ago that the fight belonged to the fittest. In those crucial seconds, strength and quickness were everything. For 30 years, he had pumped iron, practiced karate and taekwondo, not for his health, not to impress women, but for the surprise attacks. After 2 minutes of strangulation, Verno went limp. Butler pulled even tighter, then looped the ends together like a veteran sailor and secured the rope in place with a perfect double clove hitch. He stood, careful to avoid the spattered blood, and allowed himself a few seconds to admire his work. The blood bothered him. There was too much of it, and he loathed a messy crime scene. His surgical gloves were covered, and there were some small flecks on his work khakis. He should have worn black pants. What was he thinking? Otherwise, he rather admired the scene. The body was face down, arms and legs at odd angles. Blood was slowly spreading from the corpse and contrasting nicely with the new pine flooring. The white paint had splattered across the hearth and against a wall, even reaching so far as a window. The ladder on its side was a nice touch. At first glance, the next person on the scene might think Verno had taken a bad fall and struck his head. A step closer, though, and the rope would tell another story. Checklist: perimeter, phone, photo, blood, footprints. He glanced through a window and saw nothing moving in the street. He went to the kitchen and rinsed the gloves on his hands, then wiped everything carefully with a paper towel he crammed into a pocket. He closed the two back doors and locked them. Bruno's phone was on the counter next to his radio. Butler turned down the radio so he could hear and stuck the phone in his rear pocket. He picked up his clipboard and walked to the foyer where he stopped and breathed deeply. Don't waste a second, but never hurry. He was about to reach for the knob to the front door when he heard the engine of a truck. Then a door slammed. He ducked into the dining room and glanced out the window. Oh, shit. It was an oversized Ram truck parked at the curb, with Dunwoody Custom Homes painted on the driver's door. Its driver was walking across the front yard holding an envelope. Average height and weight, about 50 years old, with a slight limp. He would enter and immediately see Verno's body in the den to his left. From that moment on, he would be aware of nothing else. The killer calmly moved into position, ready with his weapon. A husky voice called out, "Verno, where are you?" Steps, a pause, then, "Lanny, you okay?" He took 3 steps into the den before the lead ball shattered the back of his skull. He fell hard, almost landing on Verno, and was too stunned, too wounded to look behind him. Butler hit him again and again, each blow splintering his cranium and spraying blood across the room. Butler hadn't brought enough rope for 2 strangulations, and besides, Dunwoody didn't deserve one. Only the special people got the rope. Dunwoody groaned and thrashed as his mortal wounds shut down his organs. He turned his head and looked at Butler, his eyes red and glazed and seeing nothing. He tried to say something, but only grunted again. Finally, he fell hard on his chest and stopped moving altogether. Butler waited patiently and watched him breathe. When he stopped, Butler took his cell phone out of a small pocket of his jacket and added it to his growing collection. Suddenly, he felt like he had been there for an hour. He checked the street again, eased out the front door, and locked it behind him. All 3 doors were locked now, which might stall them for a few minutes, and climbed into his truck. Cap down, sunglasses on, though the day had been cloudy. He backed into the street and drove slowly away. Just another inspector, closing out a busy week. He parked in a shopping center, far away from the stores and their cameras. He removed the surgical gloves and shoe covers and put them in a bag. He placed the 2 stolen phones on the seat where he could see and hear them. He tapped one, and the name Mike Dunwoody flashed on the screen. He tapped the other and saw the name Lanny Verno. He was not about to get caught with the phones and would lose them in short order. He sat for a long time and collected his thoughts. Verno had it coming. His name had been on the list for a long time as he drifted from one town to the next, from one bad romance to another, living from paycheck to paycheck. If he had not been such a shiftless and sorry bastard, his life might have been worth something. His early demise could have been avoided. He had signed his death warrant years earlier when he physically threatened the man who called himself Butler. Dunwoody's mistake was simply bad timing. He'd never met Butler and certainly didn't deserve such a violent end. Collateral damage, as they say in the military. But at that moment, Butler didn't like what he had done. He didn't kill innocent people. Dunwoody was probably a decent man with a family and a company. Maybe even went to church and played with his grandchildren. Dunwoody's phone blinked and hummed at 7:02. Marcia was calling. No voicemail. She waited 6 minutes and called again. Probably his wife, thought Butler. Really sad and all, but he had almost no capacity for sympathy or remorse. Collateral damage. It had not happened before, but he was proud of the way he handled it. Mike Dunwoody had stopped drinking years earlier, and his Friday nights in the bars were now history. Marcia wasn't worried about a relapse, though she still had vivid memories of the pub-crawling days with his buddies, almost all of whom worked in construction. In her last call that afternoon, she had been specific, stop by the grocery and get a pound of pasta and fresh garlic. She was making spaghetti and their daughter was coming over. He thought he would be home around 6 after he dropped off some checks in the subdivision. With a dozen subs building 8 houses, he lived on the phone, and if he didn't take a call, it usually meant he was on another line. If he missed a call, especially one from his wife, he returned it almost immediately. At 7:31, Marcia called his cell for the third time.
Butler looked at the screen and almost felt pity, but that lasted for only a second.
She called her son and asked him to drive to the subdivision and look for his father. No one was calling Verno.
Butler was driving on county roads and heading north, away from the coast.
He figured that by now the bodies had been discovered and the cops knew the phones were missing. It was time to get rid of them. He found the town of Neely, population 400, and drove through it. He'd been there before, scouting. The only business that appeared to be open on a Friday night was a cafe on one end of the settlement. The post office was on the other end with an ancient blue drop box outside next to a gravel drive. Butler parked in front of the tiny building, got out and walked to the door, opened it, went inside to the cramped lobby and saw a wall of small square rentals. Seeing no cameras inside or out, he left the building and casually dropped a 5x8 padded envelope in the drop box. Dale Black was the elected sheriff of Harrison County. He had finished dinner with his wife and was leashing his dog for their nightly post-meal walk through the neighborhood. His wife was already outside, waiting, checking her phone. His buzzed, and he wanted to cuss. It was the dispatcher, and any call at 8 o'clock on a Friday night was not good news. 20 minutes later, he turned into the new development and was met with an impressive display of emergency lights. He parked and hustled to the scene. A deputy, Mancuso, met him at the curb. The sheriff looked at a truck and said, "That's Mike Dunwoody's truck." "Damn sure is." "Where's Mike?" "Inside. One of the two." "Dead?" "Oh yes. Cracked skull, I'd say." Mancuso nodded across the street to another truck. "You know his kid Joey?" "Sure. That's him over there. Came out looking for his dad. Saw his truck. Went to the house, but the doors were locked. He got a flashlight and looked through the front window over there, saw the two bodies on the floor. He did not go charging in, but had the good sense to call us. I'm sure he's a mess. And then some." They walked up the drive toward the house, passing other deputies and first responders, all waiting for something to do. Mancuso said, "I kicked the kitchen door in, got inside, took a look, but kept everybody else out till now." "Nice work." They entered the house through the kitchen and flipped on every light switch. They stopped at the entrance to the den and tried to absorb the ghastly crime scene. Two lifeless bodies, faces down, heads covered in blood, dark red pools around them, paint splattered, the ladder on its side. "Have you touched anything?" Black asked. "Nothing." "I assume that's Mike," Black said, nodding. "Yes." "And the painter?" "Got no idea." "Looks like he has a wallet. Get it." In the wallet, they found a Mississippi driver's license issued to one Lanny L. Verno, address in Gulfport. The sheriff and the deputy stared at the scene for a few minutes, saying nothing, until Mancuso asked, "Got any knee-jerk reactions?" "You mean theories about what happened?" "Something like that. Joey said his dad was in the subdivision wrapping up the week, paying his subs." Black scratched his chin and said, "So Verno here got jumped, knocked off his ladder by somebody who really didn't like him. Cracked his skull, then finished him off with the rope. Then Mike showed up at the wrong time and had to be neutralized. 2 killings. The first was well planned and done for a reason. The second was not planned and done to cover up the first. You agree?" "I got nothing else,"